The unprecedented global shutdown due to the pandemic of COVID-19 is exposing public health system weakness globally. Welcome to episode 2 of the Balsillie Papers, brought to you by the Balsillie School of International Affairs. Today's episode was written in April 2020 by Margaret Walton Roberts, a human geographer who focuses on international migration and a professor at Wilfrid Laurier University and the Balsillie School of International Affairs in Waterloo, Canada. COVID-19 and Global Human Health Resources by Margaret Walton Roberts. The unprecedented global shutdown due to the pandemic of COVID-19 is exposing public health system weakness globally. In COVID-19, we are facing a virus to which we are immunologically naive, and for which it is complicated to determine an accurate case fatality rate. But we do know it is higher than influenza, and more serious for the elderly and those with comorbidities. There has been some variability in national government responses to the epidemic, depending on public health resources. But testing, contact tracing, and containment using quarantine and isolation of the infected, and social distancing to limit spread, are the main approaches. Their relative effectiveness can be seen in the Financial Times data on national infection and death rates associated with COVID-19. It is clear that in the chaos and confusion of shutdowns and shut-ins, the public have become acutely aware of what is important to them. Jobs that are usually deemed low pay and low value have become essential to the public sense of security. Grocery store clerks, care workers, nurses, and hospital cleaners have all suddenly been seen for the important work they do to maintain human systems of biological survival. In this moment of unprecedented crisis, healthcare workers, the equipment they need to do their work, and a coordinated international response have become the front line in coping with the pandemic. As countries struggle to flatten the curve of the rate of infection, it is becoming clear that we need to support frontline healthcare staff by reorganizing work processes so we do not expose vulnerable, older, and health-compromised workers at this time of acute health crisis. It is worth examining the roles and struggles of these heroes of the current pandemic in more detail. The World Health Organization's primary role is to direct and coordinate international health within the United Nations system, including health systems, health through the life course, non-communicable and communicable diseases, preparedness, surveillance and response, and corporate services. Health systems include human health resources, that is, the number, qualifications, and distribution of appropriate health workers. Numerous studies show evidence of a direct and positive link between numbers of health workers and population health outcomes. Nurses represent the largest occupational group in health globally, 2/3 of whom are women, and their role is fundamental to achieving various global health and development strategies. Considering this, it is fitting that the World Health Assembly has designated this year, 2020, as the Year of the Nurse and the Midwife. Understanding the significance of health workers during this pandemic means we need to recognize how they are made vulnerable by policy decisions. In the United States, it has been argued that physician and other healthcare worker burnout is more appropriately viewed as moral injury, since these workers struggle to provide patient care in a national healthcare system that's broken by profit-driven business models. Austerity exacts a similar toll, as was made evident in Toronto's experience of the Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome, SARS, epidemic in 2003. Austerity policies turned nurses into vectors of the SARS virus, since the majority of nurses were not employed full-time, and in order to earn an adequate wage, they were working at several part-time jobs. In moving between different hospitals, the nurses transmitted the virus. A similar situation played itself out in Seattle's first COVID-19 outbreak at a life care center nursing home. These nursing homes are among the United States' most understaffed and underfunded, where care workers typically work several jobs in nursing homes across the city. early spread of the virus may have been linked to workers moving between these locations. Underinvestment in health and long-term care effectively undermines infection control and exposes health workers to increased risk. Frontline health workers are some of the most vulnerable in this pandemic, as one infectious disease specialist has acknowledged. Quote, "For reasons that we don't understand, frontline healthcare workers are at great risk for serious illness despite their younger age." End quote. In Spain, 14% of COVID-19 cases are healthcare workers. In Brescia, Italy, 10 to 15% have been infected. When the surge of COVID-19 patients hit hospitals, reports described a warlike environment with staff exhausted, terrified, and facing post-traumatic stress disorder as they coped with the horrific reality of having to ration life-saving ventilators. In New York, nurses are wearing garbage bags in place of gowns, and reports of nurses contracting and dying due to COVID-19 exposes how dangerous this lack of personal protective equipment is. We are even seeing tragic news of nurses committing suicide after being infected by COVID-19 because they fear they may have infected patients. While health workers have been widely praised in various public displays of support, there have also been disturbing reports from the United Kingdom of National Health Service, NHS, nurses being subjected to discrimination and violence, and of nurses in the United States being evicted from their homes due to COVID-19 fears. In light of the enormous pressure placed on workers during this pandemic, there have been several efforts to expand the health workforce. Government calls for retired health workers to return to service have been answered, including 3,000 retired nurses in Ontario who answered the call to work the telehealth phone lines. Some U.S. states are accelerating the graduation of new health workers and using emergency disaster laws to fast-track permits for regulated health professionals. In India, the country with the highest number of medical schools, some basic changes to how the Medical Council of India, the MCI, licenses new health professions could result in adding 50,000 specialists in anesthesiology, pulmonology, cardiology, and radiology, and recognizing Indians who have foreign medical credentials or who graduated from schools that for various reasons are not recognized by the MCI, which could add thousands of workers. In Germany, Saxony's regional medical board called for assistance from medical doctors who do not yet have a license and received 300 responses, including many immigrant medical professionals. Some of these calls for assistance, however, have exposed what some consider a double standard, demanding maximum sacrifice but providing minimal support in return. In the Philippines, where 9 doctors have already died from coronavirus, a recent Department of Health call for, quote, "doctors, nurses, nurse assistants, and hospital orderlies able, healthy, and willing to commit to work in the fight against COVID-19, end quote, has been criticized for offering only a minimum wage, despite the massive risks the workers will face. In the United States, nursing unions are also some of the most vocal critics of government actions, demanding Medicare for all and more effective government approaches to managing the coronavirus pandemic. To fight the global pandemic, many high-income nations, those that make up the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, are already calling upon what is effectively a global health workforce. According to a recent report by the Migration Policy Institute, migrants make up 29% of physicians and 22% of nursing assistants in the United States. In the United Kingdom, 13.3% of NHS workers report a non-British nationality. In Canada, in 2018, 8.5% of nurses and 26.4% of physicians were internationally educated. The supply is sometimes at the expense of source regions, typically lower-income nations that experience out-migration as a form of brain drain. It's worth remembering that while the British are rightly proud and protective of the NHS, Its formation in the 1950s was built on the contributions of thousands of Commonwealth and Caribbean Windrush migrants, some of whose families were later subjected to appalling treatment by the UK government, including denial of government services and deportation. The importance of immigrants' contribution to the healthcare systems of many high-income nations becomes more ironic when we think about the xenophobic and nationalistic reactions of some political leaders in response to the pandemic. In the aftermath of this unprecedented global pandemic and its associated economic, social, and political effects, we need to remember the gratitude we have expressed for health workers. We must remember this at election time, when we consider political party platforms that boast mandates of tax cuts and, quote, small government. These promises generally result in cutbacks to health investment and nurses and other feminized health workers that are often disproportionately impacted by these fiscal actions. In addition, the place of international migrants in OECD healthcare systems reveals the global sourcing of workers that wealthy countries have long enjoyed. That reality demands mutual responsibility to promote and protect global health initiatives, including the support and protection of countries whose public health systems are weaker and less well organized. Today's episode was written by Margaret Walton Roberts, professor at Wilfrid Laurier University and the Balsillie School of International Affairs, and co-lead of the Migration, Mobilities, and Social Politics Research Cluster at the Balsillie School. For more episodes of the Balsillie Papers podcast, or to download PDFs of each Balsillie paper, check out www.balsillieschool.ca. Our next episode is written by the director of the Balsillie School, Professor Anne Fitzgerald. In the aftermath of COVID-19, policy implications for Canada.